Chicago Public Radio. This is Odyssey. Think of all the different ways people have of reading. People read to themselves in private. Reading can be a social activity in a book club. It can even happen among strangers on a bus or train. So the question arises, why do we read the ways we do? I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and today on Odyssey, we'll look at the activity of reading. We'll compare a variety of readers from different times in history, what they read, and why they did it. And we'll ask what we can learn by studying the history of the way we read. That's all on Odyssey, right after this. Radio. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Picking up a book and reading it may seem like a pretty straightforward thing to do. You sit down, you open it, you read it. Simple, right? Well, yes and no. The act of reading might be simple, but there is a range of practices that go along with reading. What we read, where we read, who we talk to about reading, even what we think we'll get out of reading. These practices can change a great deal across time and place. Today in the program, we're going to take a look at some of our contemporary reading practices and compare them to other ways that people have gone about the matter of reading. And joining us for our conversation today is historian Adrian Johns. He's here with me in Chicago. We're also joined from Houston, Texas by Elizabeth Long, who is a sociologist, and from Newark, New Jersey, Jonathan Rose, who is a historian of reading. Jonathan Rose, let me ask you to begin with the term reading practices. What sorts of questions or elements might fall into the category of reading practices?
Well, the question of reading practices involves how we read and what we read. For example, if you go back before 1800, people very commonly read aloud to large groups. Since then, we're more likely to read silently by ourselves. Again, if you go back to earlier centuries, people read intensively. That is to say, they read a very small, select number of texts, for example, the Bible or Pilgrim's Progress, and they read it very, very closely, again and again and again, religiously, so to speak. Today, we tend to read more extensively. We read large numbers of ephemeral books, magazines, newspapers, read them once and throw them out.
Elizabeth Long, what else would you add into this category of reading practices? What other questions might you investigate were you to undertake a study of reading practices, as you have?
The reading practices that I've investigated most intensively are collective reading practices as practiced. They're book discussion groups, so I would want to know with whom people are involved in reading, what the social context of the reading is. Is it in a classroom? Is it a group of people who are meeting together as adults? Is it, in other words, what the sort of social frame, to pick up a term both from Goffman and from Jonathan Rose's book, is of the reading? I would also want to look at how people get the books that they read. How both materially did the books come to them? It used to be much more difficult to get a hold of books than it is now. And also, how do they come culturally framed? What books are regarded as valuable? What books are regarded as trivial? And I'd like also to look at how people come to read. Do they pick it up as a program of intensive education at their parents' knees? Or do they have to struggle to get to the library and fit their reading in between other sorts of things that they must do to survive?
Adrian Johns, to some extent, some of these questions seem like they might be determined just by the material facts of your particular time and place. In other words, if there are not a lot of books in circulation, you don't have the option of reading extensively, for example. But I'm wondering how much of reading practice can be derived from books themselves. In other words, to what extent is the way we read predetermined by the fact that we're talking about books or magazines, you know, whatever particular item we might be talking about?
Well, there are certainly strategies that can be used to make books and to such that they encourage readers to approach them in a certain way. One thinks of the distinctive layout, for example, of drama publications, play scripts, On the other hand, as artifacts lying around in libraries, one also comes across in books relics of how those books have been read by previous generations of readers. Things like annotations, points where they will, where readers will refer forward to future passages or back to past passages. And there is evidence of that kind, which is evidence of how reading has gone on. However, I would agree with the previous two speakers that the layout of the page and the character of the book ultimately can't determine how it's read. And there are many examples of how books, the same book, has turned out to mean very different things in the hands of different communities of readers.
We're talking today on the program about reading practices, in particular, looking at our reading practices and comparing how they might differ from other times and places. Jonathan Rose,
yes.
You sketched out some of our reading practices. In general terms, we read silently. We tend to read extensively, in contrast to intensively. We tend to read alone, and maybe talk about it together. I'm wondering if you can sketch out some of the larger sort of parameters around which reading practices have actually varied over time.
Okay. I think that the kind of reading groups that Elizabeth Long has been studying did exist certainly in the 19th century. They were called mutual improvement societies. And people who had very little education, minors in Wales or black Americans in the 19th century, did form their own groups to discuss books and basically educate themselves. What I think has changed, although these groups, of course, still exist very commonly, I wonder whether they today reach down to the bottom of the social strata. I fear that this may be much more exclusively a middle-class kind of occupation today.
Well, Elizabeth Long, maybe we can talk about that a bit. Tell us a little bit more about your work looking at reading groups, and in particular, what you understand about why the people you were looking at came together to talk about reading.
Well, actually, my work is sort of centered on an ethnographic study of groups in Houston, and it's certainly true that almost all the women in the groups I looked at here have college degrees. So it is a very middle to upper middle to elite group of women. The groups that I looked at in the 19th century were groups that started as part of the a sort of social movement after the Civil War. And they too, excuse me, they too were pretty largely middle to upper middle class women. But there's a history of free black Americans meeting before the Civil War in reading groups, and there certainly is a history of lyceums, which engaged, and again, I would have to defer to Jonathan Rosen on this. My sense from the Houston case is that in earlier eras of the 19th century, they were composed of working men and a whole variety of people from different levels of the social order. But by the end of the 19th century, they too had become very middle class. So what drew the women in the 19th century to these groups was a desire to be educated. Most of them were people who had no hope of going to college. They saw their husband's world expanding. They saw formal education becoming more important in the world in general. It offered them a way to be out in the world that, to a certain degree, the Civil War had offered them in terms of auxiliary support, volunteer activities. So they were drawn by, I think, a desire to expand their world, and literature was one way to do that.
Okay, there's two themes that I want to pick up on in what you're just saying. The first one being this idea of coming together to read as a phenomenon that seems to go on in lots of different places, or coming together around reading, let's put it that way, seems to happen in a lot of different periods. But that's not to say that it's necessarily the same thing in all of those periods. I mean, for example, if I got together with my friends and talked about a book that I read, that might be quite different from a 19th century club that was formed for people who otherwise didn't have access to public life, for example. Or that reading might be tied more specifically to a larger project other than reading. Is that a reasonable way to look at things? Adrian Johns?
Certainly, yes. In the 19th century, for example, one sees working people's groups in Britain devoted to natural history, who would team together, often in pubs, to read natural history books, but also go around and collect plants from the local environment, bring them back and look at them over pints of beer. And these people, one of the interesting things
about... It was about the beer. Let's just be honest. The focus here is on the beer. To heck with the plants.
Well, this was England, after all. But one of the things about those groups that's very interesting is that they're not simply receptive towards knowledge which is, as it were, given to them from a relatively elite culture through books. They see themselves as aspiring to contribute to the world of books by sending in specimens to central scientific authorities, mm-hmm. for example, or writing papers, this kind of thing. And in that sense, there's a sense in which the relation between the scientific expert and the popular audience is not as simply bifurcated as we now tend to take it to be. Mm-hmm. It's much more a two-way process.
So reading could be... Oh, go ahead, Jonathan Rose.
If I could just second that, sure. I think one of the things that historians of reading have found that in the 19th century, lower class readers were very active, they were very critical, very independent. They took from books what they found valuable in them. They were not being passively brainwashed or simply following the dictates of middle class culture. And it's very exciting to discover this, and I wonder if that has been lost over time.
Elizabeth Long?
I tend not to think so. Mm-hmm. It's very clear that the women in the 19th century groups were becoming empowered, I would say, not just by the group, the books that they read, but by formulating programs of study and forming themselves as sort of constitutionally organized groups. Mm-hmm. It was very clear that this was part of a strategy of empowerment, and indeed led them to join together nationally and on the state level. So, in reformist organizations, but it's still true today, if you look at what women do in reading groups, that they take pretty actively from the books that they're reading to reflect on those things that they find interesting. And that sometimes means leaving the book entirely behind or drawing from something in the book, extending that to a problem or an issue that they want to consider. So
let me poke at that a little bit, though, because what I'd like to know is, does that necessarily mean, or are you suggesting that a book club today could serve as a link or a launching pad for some connection to a larger public sphere, or simply that within that club that might be a forum for, you know, building community around issues other than reading, or coming together around issues other than just reading?
I would not say that it's likely to spark a social movement in the way that was true in the 19th century, in part because middle class women are, after all, at least formally citizens and have opportunities to move into the public sphere of not just citizenship and politics, but also socially organized work and employment and so on. But women do still stand, even middle-class women, in a problematic relationship to a lot of the institutions of our country, and so there are still problems and issues that people work out, but people tend to make a difference between public action, which they take in various other specialized organizations, and the kind of reflective consideration of things that goes on in book groups. So I think that the relationship between the public sphere and reading practices, at least for middle-class women, is different now. But I'm not willing to say that they're doing something that has no impact, potential impact, in the broader world, because I do think that that kind of ideational reflection plays a part, although a less direct and obvious part, in changing the way we think and the way we frame our lives and mm-hmm. therefore the way that we act.
All right, when we come back, I'd like to think a little bit more about this public aspect of reading, particularly with a couple of examples coming out of our own fine city of Chicago that will give us a chance to mull over the public-private axis of the reading question. We're talking today about reading practices, our own and those of other times and places, so I hope you'll stay with us. There's more to come on Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey.
Hi. On Friday, all eyes will be on the opening ceremonies of the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. 150 countries have gathered to compete in moguls, cross-country skiing, biathlon, ice hockey, and figure skating. What are you looking forward to watching? I'm Neil Conan. Join us on the Olympic coverage next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
That's at 2 o'clock today on WBEZ Chicago. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by Home First Health Services, specializing in home birth and family health care in the Chicagoland area for over 30 years. Information is available at homefirst.com or 847-679-8336. You're listening to WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM, Chicago Public Radio. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and on the program today we're talking about reading practices, all of the activities and decisions and choices that circle around and add up to the way we read. And joining us for the conversation is Jonathan Rose, who is the author of The Intellectual Life of the British Working Class, which won the Longman History Today Prize for Best History Book of 2001. He's an associate professor of history at Drew University, where he directs the graduate program in book history. He's also the founder of the Society for the History of Authorship, Reading, and Publishing, and he joins us today from Newark, New Jersey. Also with us is Elizabeth Rose, who is the author of Women Reading Together, Book Clubs, and the Fashioning of Female Subjectivity. Elizabeth Rose is an associate professor of sociology at Rice University in Houston, Texas, and she joins us today from Houston. Here in Chicago is Adrian Johns, who wrote The Nature of the Book, Print and Knowledge in the Making. The book examines the history of authorship and publishing methods. Professor Johns teaches history and history of science at the University of Chicago. I'd like to talk a bit more, if we can, about the public-private access, because here in our own fine city of Chicago, we have two interesting examples of attempts with varying degrees of success, to re-inject reading into the public sphere to a greater degree. One is the, of course, ubiquitous example of Oprah's Book Club, which comes out of Chicago, but a nationally broadcast and you know, nationally reaching collective reading activity. And then also we had here in Chicago a project called City of Big Readers, where citizens of Chicago were supposed to read To Kill a Mockingbird and then enjoy the experience together. I'm not entirely sure how successful that project was, but it seems to me that this might reveal a sort of longing for a more collective approach to reading, or at least to exchange of ideas around reading than people normally have access to. What do you think about that proposition, Jonathan Rose?
Well, it certainly does to some extent, and I'm not going to criticize Oprah's Book Club, but something does bother me a bit about it, and that is I think some people who studied it have noted that the people who follow the book club read the books that Oprah tells them to read, but then don't usually read very far beyond that. In contrast, the reading groups I think that Elizabeth Long and I have studied were very self-directed. The members chose the books, and they sort of led the discussion. So I am a little bit concerned that this kind of reading may be more passive than those of an earlier generation who were more deprived of educational opportunities.
Elizabeth Long, what do you think of that?
Well, I've actually heard some anecdotal evidence that groups of readers who are not very self-confident will often start out with Oprah's selections and then move into a more self-directed program of reading choices. So I think at least the potential is there, but like Jonathan Rose, I have some problems with the Oprah phenomenon. It's really interesting when you talk to people, interview people, almost everyone will say, I don't want to say anything bad about Oprah because she is getting people reading again. And it's very clear that that is happening. But if you look, and I haven't done a lot of this, at the way that she asks people to read on the show, or the way that reading is framed on the show, that is very directive and often stays at a level of sort of personal identification that a lot of the people who read in the reading groups that I studied do do tend to mix up with more complicated and interesting ways of getting into and getting things out of a book.
Well, let's expand on that idea. I'm interested in the different ways in which people might understand what it means to read. In other words, what am I going to do when I read a book? And you're suggesting, Elizabeth Long, that maybe there's a narrow framing in the context of Oprah's book club, that you're going to read this story and you're going to see yourself reflected in this story. And that's certainly probably an experience that many people have had of, you know, finding themselves in a character or something like that. But what are some other ways that people have understood what reading is? Adrienne Johns?
That's a really interesting question that gets back to what you said in introducing the program about the whole point of the history of reading. The fact is that very often when one is reading a book, one does feel transformed in some way by it, captured by it. And I think if there's a thing that makes people believe that reading is ultimately transhistorical, that there is something common to almost the human condition to reading, it's that experience of simply being picked up by a book and taken along. But what I would want to point out is that there's a long history of ways in which that moment of being captured has been described by people. So if you go back to the 16th century, you will find people describing it in terms of contemporary medicine, of humoral physiology. In the 17th century, it'll be in terms of circulation systems to do with Harvey and the nervous system, which then was being investigated by anatomists. In the 18th century, it's in terms derived from John Locke and sensations moving through the eye and into the perceptual mechanism. And in the 19th century, perhaps most interestingly, it often comes down to conceptions like mesmerism and animal magnetism, reflex physiology, phrenology. So in other words, even if there is something which is ultimately immediate and beyond our control about reading, as soon as we start to think about what it is, we become again subject to our historical circumstance. And then that carries through into what we think reading can do to our culture and how we think reading perhaps ought to be disciplined or constrained in any way. And one of the things that I was going to say about that, which relates back to the previous topic, is that there is a very long history of attempts to delimit popular reading practices by means of circulating a restricted list of books or a restricted category of books, which goes back to almost the invention of printing. In the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, there are attempts to circulate reform of manners books, which will render the populace, it was thought, civil, polite, and not so much learned, but sound moral beings. And that carries through into the 18th century and the 19th. And in the 19th century, these natural history groups, for example, were being deluged with steam-printed, very orthodox Christian works of natural philosophy, which they often rebelled against. Now, those
because the type of natural philosophy that they were pursuing was seen as at odds with traditional religious notions?
Yes. There's a great line from one of these groups which retorted that they wanted really useful knowledge, but the authorities in London simply wanted to ram kangaroos down their throats. and these were organizations like the Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge, which mass-produced rather tedious works of theological natural history at affordable prices for the working class. And I'm not saying that things like the Oprah Project are a straightforward extension of those, but they do share a sense that reading practices can be conditioned from the center outwards. And the thing is that historically, those kinds of projects have never been a huge success because of the irreducible individuality of reading, in the sense that the people are just captured by books.
Adrienne Johns is the author of The Nature of the Book, Print and Knowledge in the Making. He is a professor of history and the history of science at the University of Chicago. We're also talking today with Elizabeth Long, who is the author of Women Reading Together, Book Clubs and the Fashioning of Female Subjectivity. She's an associate professor of sociology at Rice University in Houston, Texas, and she joins us from there today. And we're talking with Jonathan Rose, who's the author of The Intellectual Life of the British Working Class. He's an associate professor of history at Drew University, where he directs the graduate program in book history. We are talking today about reading practices and looking at reading practices through history. We'll be taking some phone calls later in the program. Our number is 1-888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. 1800. Jonathan Rose, maybe I can ask you to pick up where Adrian Johns left off, because one thing that I got interested in looking at many of your various works is this question of individual choice versus sort of following orders. In other words, how different people at different times understand what they're supposed to read. Can you talk a little bit about the working class readers who you were looking at? How did they decide what they were going to read?
Well, mostly they simply followed their own star, and they asked friends, they shared books, they exchanged books. In the coal fields of South Wales, the miners founded their own libraries and acquired books on their own. They did have some guidance. There was a Victorian social reformer, Sir John Lubbock, who came out with a list of the 100 best books ever written. And it was a little bit pretentious, I agree. But it turned out to be,
It wasn't going to be the last time somebody tried.
No, if anyone had ever attempted that. I mean, we're talking to a Chicago program where, of course, the Great Brooks programs originated. But I think these kinds of lists, in fact, were very helpful to self-educated readers as a starting point. I mean, I don't think anyone really limited themselves to what Sir John Lubbock recommended, and that was not his intention at all. It was, it gave them a very rough map of the territory, and from there they could branch out. Tommy Jackson, who was a very radical Marxist proletarian intellectual, said, "I started with, you know, this list of 100 books, and it was a revelation to me. And it was it started me reading in all sorts of directions, even though Marx certainly was not on the list." So in this sense, these kinds of lists, though they seem conservative and stodgy and limited, could in fact have very radical consequences.
Now, I want to say one other, ask you to talk about one other interesting and sort of a little bit quirky thing about the readers that you studied, which was that sometimes they would gather together and read to each other, something that is rarely done now, except I think from parents to children, but that they would, one person would read while the others were working.
Oh, it's very common in workshops. If they were all, shoemakers, one worker would be delegated to read aloud while the others worked. It was sort of like having a transistor radio, you know, going on in the background. Or just at home, you know, families would sit around in the kitchen and one person would read from a book, and, you know, the mother would be attending to the cooking and the kids would be doing their homework, and everybody listened in, so to speak. So in this sense, even into the early 20th century, I think reading in working class homes was very much a kind of collective activity.
Elizabeth Long, does any of that go on in the contemporary reading groups that you were looking at? I'm really intrigued by the whole reading aloud thing. I'm not sure why, but it seems so odd.
which proves that we're framed ourselves as readers. most of these groups don't do that. Most of them assign books, pick books, and then people go home, read them, and then they come back. They read aloud, you know, in bits and pieces from the books in the groups. There are a few groups that do this sort of intensive reading aloud of often playwrights like Shakespeare. People will gather and read their way aloud through his works, or through at least part of his work. But I wonder, I wanted to ask a question of Jonathan Rose.
Yes, yes.
There were two questions, actually. One is, you end up the introduction of your book saying that this is a success story, the story of these independent-minded and sort of eager working-class readers who are making the world their own through ideas, that it's a success story, but it ends on a downbeat. And I would love for you to talk more about that, and I'm also really intrigued at your take on the possibility that looking at audiences can deal with some of the drier aspects of the high culture canons as ideological baggage versus high culture canons as the best that we have known and thought, because I thought that you had a really interesting take on that debate.
Jonathan Rose? So
that's a lot of questions.
They're good ones, so we'll go with it.
I'll take them one by one. Yeah, it is a success story with a bittersweet ending in this sense that I think that this autodidact tradition to a considerable extent has been lost, at least amongst people below the level of the middle class, and I think Elizabeth Long, unfortunately, has confirmed that. But
by that you mean, let me stop you, by that you mean an approach to reading as self-improvement. In other words, reading is edifying experience.
In the 19th century, self-improvement meant mental and moral and intellectual self-improvement. Today it means tightening up various body parts, and
relationships.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, and I think that when the book was published in the UK, some people thought I was criticizing the introduction of public education, which of course I was not. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're better off with universal education. But the loss of the tradition of self-education has been a loss, and we have to take that into account. Elizabeth's second question regarding if we study how common readers read the classics, does this cast a question, a light on a question that literary critics have been debating for the last generation, i.e., do the great books carry all kinds of ideological baggage about race and class and gender and so on? And I think, yes, I think this is a very useful corrective to much of what has been written about that lately, because I think there's an assumption amongst academics that if you find racism or sexism or whatever in Moby Dick or Thomas Hardy, that these values are communicated unproblematically to readers. In fact, as I've said, I think that common readers are very independent and selective and critical, and they did not derive those kinds of prejudices from what they read. Quite the contrary. I think they found the great books very inspiring and deeply liberating.
Adrian Johns, let me ask you a question. Is it secretly the agenda of people who want to look at readers to find out everything they can about readers in order to know more about the books? Because it seems like a lot of the people who are interested started out interested in books and then came to the point where they said, well, we figured out all we can just by looking at the book. Now we got to go look at the people who read them.
Oh, it's an open agenda. No secret.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, I can reveal this for the first time. I think there's a certain sense in which that's true, but really what we're interested in are processes of cultural change and, for that matter, cultural stasis. We want to understand what it is that changes when we in general think that there is a change in culture. Because it used to be that what historians did was to look back and look at, as it were, straightforwardly, alterations in the content of books. Not that that's an easy thing to do, but nonetheless, that was the agenda. And what's become clear in looking at reading audiences is that there are often changes which are at least as profound when the same books, or at least the same texts, mm-hmm. are used by different communities in different ways. Incidentally, about the reading aloud thing, one thing that I point out is that there is one community where reading aloud is still very live, which is the academic community. This is what we do almost all the time, is we go to colloquia and we read aloud. And it's strange that we as academics tend to concentrate on, as it were, the working classes when we think about reading aloud. But in the modern world, at least, it's something which is most live in our own rather high cultural elite.
Jonathan Rose, let me ask you a question. We have to take another break soon, but I wanted to ask this, and that is, how close do you think all of this investigation of reading practices gets to that center kind of maybe, dare I use the term, magical point of mm-hmm. whatever might be transhistorical about reading? I mean, is this are you triangulating in on that point?
I think to some extent I am. I wouldn't say that reading is ever entirely transhistorical because, yes, even authors that have been classics that have been survived over many centuries are read in different ways in different historical periods. But I think that some of the inspirational experience that Adrian Johns referred to is in one sense transhistorical, and maybe what's actually changing is the metaphors that we're using to describe it. The experience itself may be actually very, very much the same.
The sort of whatever the fundamental pleasure or joy of reading is.
It might be described in medical terms in one century. In the 19th century, it's often described in terms of a religious conversion, an epiphany. Mm-hmm. But that may be simply different words for the same experience.
All right. Yeah, let's. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation and also take some phone calls at 1-888-859-1800. 800-800-7800. Give us a call if you have a question or a comment about reading, reading practices. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you are listening to Odyssey. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, presenting Chicago in the World Forum, Islam and the West, a four-lecture series. Frank G. Wisner, Vice Chairman at the American International Group, will lead a discussion on Tuesday, February 19th at 6 p.m. Further information is at 312-726-3860 or online at ccfr.org. Chicago Public Radio would like to thank all of our program sponsors. They play an important part in bringing quality programming to our listeners every day. You can thank them, too, by mentioning you heard them on WBEZ on Chicago Public Radio. This is 91.5 FM, WBEZ Chicago. Welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and today on the program we're talking about reading practices, looking at our reading practices and reading practices at other times in history, why we might like to do that, what we think it might tell us. We're going to take some phone calls in a minute at 1-888-859-1800, but let me remind everybody that we're talking today with Adrian Johns, who is a historian. He teaches history and history of science at the University of Chicago. He's the author of The Nature of the Book, Print and Knowledge in the Making. We're also talking with Elizabeth Long, who's the author of Women Reading Together, Book Clubs and the Fashioning of Female Subjectivity. She's a professor, associate professor of sociology at Rice University in Houston, Texas. She's joining us from Houston. And Jonathan Rose, who's the author of The Intellectual Life of the British Working Class, which won the Longman History Today Prize for Best History Book of 2001. He teaches history at Drew University. Let's take some phone calls. Let's talk with Patrick. Hello, Patrick. You're on Odyssey.
Hi there. You've sort of touched on a couple of my comments, but in the discussion about the literary snobbery between the what Mr. Rhodes is calling the self-educated readers and the perceived passivity of the disciples of the Oprah's Book Club, I'm one of those readers that if someone's nagging me to read a book, and they're telling me how good it is, I'm less likely to read it, especially if I'm seeing it all the time on the bus or on the L. Because to me, it's like people are accessorizing with books. So I'm wondering, what's the bridge between the two camps, the self-educated reader and the popular books, which may have literary value?
What's the bridge between them?
Well, is there, I avoided Harry Potter, for example, because everyone was telling me I should read it, and I read it, and I enjoyed it. You know, the other books you can leave, but I enjoyed Harry Potter. It took a lot of fighting. So how do we pull me into the Harry Potter camp without me feeling like I'm a slave to popular culture?
How can we secretly let Patrick know which books it's okay for him to read, even if they have the Oprah sticker on them? Giving you a hard time, Patrick. But Jonathan Rose, do you want to take a whack at that question?
Well, there's no doubt that books, do furnish a room in the sense that they are prestige items. I mean, one of the reasons we put them on bookshelves in our living room is to advertise, what we have read. And by the way, it's one reason I think that the electronic book will never succeed, because it leaves no evidence that you've actually read the book. You can't actually put it on display there. That being said, I think that if we go back to the Victorian period, many of the books that working people or Black Americans, for example, read, they got out of secondhand bookstalls, off of rubbish bins, because it was all they could afford to do. So these books were a little tattered and didn't quite have that prestige factor. They were old books. But I think they were read more purely for their content.
Well, yeah. Do you think, I'm interested, as I'm thinking about Patrick's question, it occurs to me that, it occurs to me to ask whether we live in a time when the option of not reading a book is there. In other words, that there are so many books that you would have to choose among them and that you might avoid certain books, whereas other people at other times there were the books and you read them. I mean, there just weren't as many choices.
Oh yes, if you were growing up as a minor in the 19th century, you had very few books available to you, and so you just read everything you possibly could.
You wouldn't worry about wasting your time on Harry Potter or.
You read if there was Jane Eyre on the bookshelf, you read it. If there was the Proceedings of the Methodist Conference, you read that.
There was
an absolute shortage of books, and yes.
So there is some of that still hunger for reading.
I agree with you.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Right.
But I agree. I mean, if you lived in Texas after the Civil War, it was hard to get books, just literally. There were no railroads to speak of. Books had to come by, they got shipped into the ports, and then they had to be conveyed out to the provinces by people on horseback at best. So that's, I think, one reason that a lot of these people read the classics was because the classics ended up getting around in a way that... that now Harry Potter gets around.
All right, let's take another call. Let's talk with Dave. Hi, Dave. You're on Odyssey.
Hi. I have a question that relates to how academic reading is different than reading for pleasure. Say, for example, Oprah's book club. That sort of reading to me seems very different because, as you talked about earlier, I think there's a distinction between reading intensively and reading comprehensively. To get a broad sense of what's going on. And as one of your guests mentioned, I think works such as Moby Dick or Thomas Hardy's that bring out issues of racism can't really be discerned by the naked eye. I mean, you really need to read them intensively. And so I was wondering if your guests could just comment on that. I'll just take my answer off the air.
All right. Who'd like to respond to that? Adrian Johns?
Yeah, I'll say something to that. The distinction between intensive and extensive reading works on a broad level, but it's still possible for people to read intensively today, and it does happen to a certain extent. The main difference between academic reading and pleasurable reading, it seems to me, I'm afraid, is that pleasurable reading is fun, and academic reading isn't. academic reading is really hard work. I spend a lot of my time having to pore over footnotes, to really kind of labor to get a point out of some text that is in front of me. And I must say, just introspectively, it's difficult actually to back out of that practice when I go home in the evening and then read a novel without thinking about each sentence and thinking, how can I use that as a quote somewhere?
You have a lot of footnotes in your book, Adrian Johns. I just want to point that out. There are other scholars out there reading your book going, oh, footnotes.
Don't knock it. It got me tenure. well, there is truth to that. I've lost my thread a bit.
Sorry about that.
What intensive reading doesn't have, I think, today, as applied to academics, which it used to have in the 17th, 18th centuries, is it doesn't have quite the power to take you over and transform you. If you read radical religious testimonies from the 17th or 18th century, the kinds of things that were produced by sects, they're often accounts of being transmuted from an old kind of reading, which was often called just book religion, where one recited prayers rote, to a very spiritual, almost mystic, intensive negotiation with individual words in scripture. And it's often said that I opened the book of God and a passage seized me and there was nothing I could do about it. Academic books don't do that to you, believe me.
But even the type of reading that gets called close reading, careful reading of even non-academic texts, and intense reading is still not necessarily the same thing as intensive reading in contrast to extensive reading on this large historical scale, Jonathan Rose, that you were talking about or that you mm-hmm. you referred to at the beginning of our conversation. We're still talking about a different thing, aren't we?
Oh, very much so. The kind mm-hmm. of intensive reading that people indulged in 200 years ago was, I think, religious. First of all, they're reading religious books, and they're reading them religiously. They're reading them for a source of inspiration. The kind of academic close reading we do is much more dry and desiccated, believe me.
You all sound so unhappy.
We are. We're all miserable in our work. Yeah.
All right, let's take another phone call. Let's talk with Ron. Hello, Ron. You're on Odyssey.
Yes, thank you. I was struck by your comment, Gretchen, about how it seems so odd reading out loud to you. I many years ago, I had the experience of reading Melville's The Confidence Man with a friend. We read it. We started on a road trip and read it over a period of time. And both of us look back on that. We talked about it just a few weeks ago as one of the best experiences, reading experiences we've ever had.
You did it in the car?
Well, actually, just for a, for a few days, and then it was whenever we got together, we'd take on a chapter or whatever.
Because I was actually, I recalled as the show had was unfolding, I recalled that I did once have this experience of driving a long distance with a friend and reading aloud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were reading My Life with Elvis, not Melville.
Both of us realized a few things out of that. I probably wouldn't have finished the book had I been reading it on my own. It was such a convoluted way to write, and I distinctly recall we'd read a long sentence and look at one another and say, what was that about, and go back and reread it, and it gave us a different reading experience and a different appreciation for what was there.
Well, thanks very much for calling about that. Is there more reading aloud going on than I know about, do you think? I mean, outside of academic reading, or, you know, when you're talking, Adrian Johns, when you were talking about the academic setting, you're mostly reading your own papers to colleagues.
By and large, yes. Mm-hmm. Occasionally it happens.
And everybody thinks it's a really bad idea, too.
And yet it persists.
It persists, I think, partly because you're supposed to sound really scholarly at these conferences, So people get worried that if they're just talking, they won't be as impressive and make the points that they have to make. At least that's been my experience. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm the only unself-confident person on this panel, but... Yeah.
Too many secret confessions coming out today. Yeah.
The business about being in a car is interesting because this is, of course, a context for reading that people wouldn't normally think of because you have to actually drive. In Los Angeles, I have seen people driving while reading, but it's not something you'd recommend. But books on tape, of course, do allow you to as it were, read. And that's, as it were, having somebody read a whole novel aloud to you. And it is an interesting exercise to do if you're used just to reading text silently to yourself, because it is a different experience. You do get a different sense of the rhythm and structure of a work.
Then you seem to have at least two interpreters, which you don't if you're reading by yourself, because you have there's the text and then the person reading it and then your response to the way they're reading it.
Absolutely, yes.
True.
Let's take one more call before the end of the hour. Let's talk with Greg. Hello, Greg. You're on Odyssey.
Hi. Hi. My question is about, you've been talking about, like, intents of the next sense of reading and pleasure, and I wanted to hear what everyone had to think about different kinds of reading pleasure. I mean, there's something very different in the reading pleasure you get from, like, a quick narrative, like a John Grisham, than in something like a Moby Dick or something where you kind of have to read and reread to kind of get where things are going. And, it seemed interesting in terms of what you were talking about, issues of class in reading and how, popular reading goes today. So I'll just hang up and listen.
Jonathan Rose, I'd like to pose that question to you in this way in particular. When you talk about your working class readers reading for self-improvement, where was the notion of pleasure in that?
Well, it was there, in fact, in a very intense way. You have to bear in mind these are people who spent their entire life, taking orders. They were not supposed to be thinking for themselves. Their bosses would commonly tell them, I'm the one who's paid to do the thinking here, And reading gave them a tremendous sense of independence, the sense that they could frame the world in their own terms, understand it in their own terms, create their own standards of beauty or justice or truth or whatever. So the pleasure derived from that is a different kind of pleasure from the pleasure that comes from reading a good yarn, of course, but it's also, it's very intense and almost, again, a kind of religious revelation.
Jonathan Rose is the author of The Intellectual Life of the British Working Class, which won the Longman History Today Prize for the best history book of 2001. He is Associate Professor of History at Drew University, where he directs the graduate program in book history. Elizabeth Long, let me ask you as a final thought, what do you think, ultimately, where do you think that the undertaking of examining the history of reading ought to go?
Well, I think we need a lot more empirical work. One of the really interesting things about the history of reading is how many people say it ought to be done and how few people actually do it. So I would say we need to know how people were reading, and that means contemporary as well as historically. But I think that Adrian Johns had a really good point when he said we're interested in it because we're interested in cultural stasis and cultural change. So investigating the connections between reading and the social world, to put it really bluntly, would be my interest in the history of reading, and I actually have the feeling that the other panelists share some of that interest.
Elizabeth Long is the author of Women Reading Together, Book Clubs and the Fashioning of Female Subjectivity. She's an associate professor of sociology at Rice University in Houston, Texas. She joined us from Houston, Texas today. Adrian Johns, final thought from you? Do you agree with Elizabeth Long?
Absolutely, yes. No, I think she's dead on. One thing that I would say is that the history of reading encourages us to look at the lastingness of practices as opposed to concrete things like books themselves. And that might throw light on the changes that we're now facing with digitization and the proclaimed end of the book. It seems to me that that end isn't going to happen as long as new media forms are not amenable to our pleasurable practices of reading. We need to be able to take e-books to the beach, drop them in the bath, and not worry about them exploding or electrocuting us or just breaking. We can do that with paperbacks. We can't do it yet with e-books, and e-books will only work when we can.
Adrian Johns is the author of The Nature of the Book, Print and Knowledge in the Making. He's also a professor of history and history of science at the University of Chicago. Adrian Johns, Elizabeth Long, and Jonathan Rose, thank you all so much for joining me today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey's theme music is composed and performed by OK Go. Our program comes to you every day through the efforts of several people, including our technical producer, Steve Warnauskas, our associate producer, Allison Cuddy, and our senior producer, Joshua Andrews. The managing producer of our program is Edward Lifson. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio under general manager Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Join us next time for Odyssey.
Odyssey is marketed and distributed by Marja Strushko. Funding for the program is provided by a generous grant from Doris Sasser and the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. To listen to this show again, go to our website, chicagopublicradio.org/odyssey. You can find information there on how to order a tape of the show. That's chicagopublicradio.org/odyssey.